The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Potsy of the People. On this episode, we talk a lot about voting. So we have the news with me, Brittany, Clinton, Sam, as always. We also have Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, Ari Berman, who is a senior reporter with Mother Jones, and then we have Faz Shakir, who is the National Political Director of the ACLU. Before we jump into this episode, I'll just say a brief comment about what power looks like. Is that what I'm mindful of is that there are many ways to build power. We build power in the street, at the dinner table, in the classroom, at the boardroom. We also build power at the ballot box. And there's not just one way to build power. I worry that I've heard so much rhetoric that's like, I'm not going to vote because that's not the way to build power. It's like the reality is that there's no one way to build power. There are many ways that we build power. And we need to make sure that we use every tool in our toolkit. And that is one of the reasons why you vote. You vote as another way to build power. And I think about power as the ability to influence a decision-making process. And politics is the decision-making process. And you want to make sure that you can push on that process as much as possible. That the people who are trying to convince you that this is a tool you don't need are the people who are using this tool every single day to advance their agenda. So I know that one vote alone doesn't necessarily change the world immediately. And I say that as somebody who got tear gas, arrested, all those things, and I voted my entire life, and it didn't stop that from happening. I also know that in a conversation about building power, voting in the ballot box is one important way. Let's go. And now the news with me, Brittany Packnett, a former member of the Ferguson Commission, appointed by President Obama to the Task Force on 21st Century Policing, and an incredible leader in education. We have Samuel Sinyangwe, our resident data scientist, and Clint Smith III, our resident academic.
Hey, everybody. It's the news. This is Brittany Packnett at Ms. Pacchetti on all social media.
And this is Sam Sinyangwe at Sam Sway on Twitter.
What's going on, y'all? This is Clint Smith at Clint Smith III.
Hi. And this is DeRay at DeRay, D-R-E-Y on Twitter.
So obviously, one of the pieces of news that's on everybody's mind right now is the mass shooting that happened in Sutherland Springs, Texas on Sunday. Gunmen massacred parishioners in a small Texas church, killing 26 people. The more information comes out about it, the more it looks like it is tied to domestic issues with regard to the man's partner and seeking some sort of to enact some sort of violence against his partner's family. And he ended up killing his partner's grandmother-in-law, or his grandmother-in-law, rather. But, you know, this is another example of what is just an endless stream of deaths that are happening in ways that are becoming frightening, and how normal they're beginning to feel. And I think, you know, we are constantly reminding ourselves that this is not normal, that it is not acceptable, that the reason that the United States has the problem with these heinous acts of violence is because we have so many guns. And you know, it's beyond the point of naming it as a double standard. You know, it was just not so long ago, about a week ago, we had what happened in New York, and we saw the reaction from the president with regard to calling for the death penalty for the man who had immigrated from Uzbekistan and killed the folks in New York with the truck. And then this happens, and you see a wholly different reaction. And it's not just the president; it's reflective of so many different folks in our political stratosphere. And And it's just exhausting, you know, it's exhausting and it's easy to become disillusioned by this. And, I'm just sad for the families and sad that this is where we are.
Yeah. Clint, you mentioned, you know, this guy had a record, of red flags that should have, led to some sort of identification that he was at risk and, some sort of measure to prevent him from getting his hands on an assault weapon. You know, the gunman was jailed for domestic abuse. He was kicked out of the military. He was even charged with animal cruelty. So, you know, this is not rocket science, right? Like one thing, there are too many guns in the country. We know that. But even among people and getting access to more guns, people who don't have guns, that whole process is just devoid of any type of real solid evidence-based approach to identifying who is most at risk and preventing those people from getting access to guns, especially assault weapons. So, you know, again, there are common sense solutions to all of this, but it's all about political will to put them in place. And especially when it's a white gunman, a white man, who we know the majority of these gunmen are, you know, you don't see any type of serious policy-based response, particularly from conservatives. And I think that that's a real problem. And this will continue to happen until it is taken seriously across the aisle.
Yeah, Sam, I think this point that you really brought up is critically important. I am personally becoming more aware of research that, quite frankly, has been out there for a long time, expressly connecting occurrences of domestic violence with mass killings. So one report states that out of the 318 mass killing incidents between 2006 and 2016, about half of those involved family members killing relatives and loved ones. So unfortunately, there's a direct correlation between domestic and intimate partner violence and the mass shootings that we are becoming all too familiar with in this country and have been all too familiar with. There are loopholes like the boyfriend loophole that they just talked about on Full Frontal last week that put firearms in the hands of domestic abusers. Often we pull up the idea of mental illness and blame that. Some important disability activists online and advocates for mental health pointed out the fact that really we are not decreasing the stigma against mental health, but we're actually increasing the stigma when we blame that solely instead of the lack of gun control, the lack of political will, the lack of assurances that abusers and known abusers will not be able to get their hands on firearms as the causes for the kinds of things that we're seeing. Because there are lots of folks dealing with mental illness every single day who do not choose to pick up a firearm and kill innocent people. And so, you know, the last thing I'll say is there are so many times where we have been here over and over and over again. And I'm over thoughts and prayers, right? I mean, thoughts and prayers are important, but I am a person of faith myself. And the Bible that I read says that faith without works are dead. And so it is not inappropriate to be talking about gun control right now. It's actually very necessary to be talking about gun control right now and the kind of policy solutions and actions that communities, that power holders, that power wielders need to be taking right now in order to save lives, to prevent these kinds of tragedies from happening. If you don't get into politics to save lives, then you should get out right now.
And when we think about gun control, which is the natural conversation that leads from this, you know, we're reminded that we can do this. And we want to be mindful that we have gun control that highlights the role of manufacturers, that what we don't want is to just like penalize people who have guns, because we think that will likely lead to an over representation of black and brown people being caught up in the system again. But what is true is that nobody in Chicago is like making assault rifles in their backyard, right? The guns are coming from somewhere. And part of this conversation has to be about how we just have less guns. And Brittany, it's important that we talk about the relationship between domestic violence and mass shootings, something that I also didn't know about until rather recently. You know, Chris Rock has that joke in his stand-up that talks about there's no like right to bullets, right? That like we could also price out bullets, right? Like there are many ways that we could actually get to this issue of not having guns cause so much damage in neighborhoods and communities. And it is sort of wild that we've had two mass shootings in such a close period of time, and people still are like, Congress is still squeamish about whether there should be gun control or not.
So these things happen and we, you know, quickly begin to look at the political landscape as we should, because we should be considering, like, what are you actually, what concrete steps are congressional leaders actually taking to prevent things like this from happening again? And when they're not doing those things, they should be held accountable. But I just want to, like, really reground us in the fact that, you know, sometimes the political conversations which are necessary take us away from, like, the human implications and kind of take us away from, like, the human impact. And, you know, part of what I always think about when I see these things is that, you know, I think of all the times that my own mother, like, rushed me out of the house on our way to church and saying, like, let's go to church, it's time to go, finish your breakfast. And I think of how the people who were going to church that day, they woke up, they had their breakfast, they kissed their children, they kissed their husbands, they kissed their wives, they tied their shoes, they put their dishes in the sink, they got in the car, they went to this church, and that there's no way that they could know what would happen to them. And I think about how arbitrary violence can be. And certainly there is a relationship, as we've mentioned, between domestic violence and intimate partner violence and the manifestations of these sort of larger acts of violence as well. But I really just want us to remember how these are people who woke up as if it were any other day, and how frightening it is that we live in a country where any of us can wake up and think that we are going to have the day that we imagine, that there are kids in that church who were excited for their birthdays, that there were people in that church excited for their wedding anniversaries, that there were people who were just excited to make dinner that night. And so I really would just want us to remember, like, part of what makes these acts of violence so nefarious and horrific is how arbitrary they are, and how this could be any of us. And that is reflective of the really dangerous policies that we have in place that make it so that this could really happen anywhere and to anybody.
Thanks for that really important reminder, Clint, especially as we work to not become desensitized to the massive amounts of gun violence that we experience in this country. As we post this pod, it is election day all across America. Nearly one third of states are experiencing an election today. I think it's really important for us to remember that we vote for more than just ourselves. When you show up at the polls, think about all of the folks that we discuss often on this pod, people who are returning citizens or are formerly incarcerated, folks who are undocumented, children who need their voice to be heard but do not experience the franchise. There are lots of conversations about if voting is worth it and all of those kinds of things, but I think it's critically important to remember that it's not just about us. All across the country, there are really important races happening in places like Minneapolis, Seattle, and Charlotte. There are critical mayoral races. Folks in Virginia and Washington State have the opportunity to shift majorities in state House and Senate. And there's an all-important governor's race happening in Virginia. And there are school board races, city council races, races for alderperson happening all across the country and in potentially in your local jurisdiction. I've had some really important conversations over the last few days, both online and offline, about the choice to abstain from voting. And I think it's really important that we recognize this is not an either or, that folks have to get out there and participate to secure safety and health in our communities right now. Simultaneous to that, we can be building a real vision for the future that goes beyond two parties and goes beyond kind of candidates as messiah. But we can do both of those things at the same time. And it's so important to participate right now.
Brittany, you mentioned some of the races that are going on Election Day, and just to take a step back and think about how important these are. So when we talk about governor's races and state legislatures, whether that's in New Jersey or in Virginia, you know, these are the positions that will decide criminal justice in the state, the positions that will decide reproductive rights, that will decide economic justice and the minimum wage. I mean, these are positions that is pretty much on any issue, on most issues, the states control the majority of what happens related to that issue. And so these are the races to show up for, the races that where you will have the most power and influence in actually shaping and improving people's lives in your state. And so, you know, this is something to show up for. It's something to tell all your family and friends and, you know, your Facebook friends who are in that state to show up for. We really need to build a movement and a coalition to change some of the dynamics, particularly in places like Virginia, which, you know, have had a solidly Republican state legislature and have passed a number of bills that have been incredibly harmful to communities, immigrant communities, women, people of color. And so we need to push back against that.
Yeah, you both make really, really important points. And I'm thinking about what you said, Brittany, and I'm thinking about how on the left, it feels like we have not yet figured out how to have a conversation around the limits of electoral politics without falling into the trap of becoming fully disillusioned with electoral politics. And I think of, you know, people that I know and love and respect who have suggested that pulling out of electoral politics and not voting is the way to convince folks that the system needs to be sort of fully dismantled and recalibrated, and that none of the political parties are actually serving our interests. And I think that it is critically important to be critical of, to imagine a different context for, to push ourselves to think differently around the ways in which we can hold elected officials accountable without removing ourselves in our entirety from the system. Because what we recognize is that part of this happened in 2016. There were a lot of folks who were very disillusioned by what was happening in this country. This was a sort of post Trayvon, post Ferguson, post Eric Garner. This is in the midst of a lot of sort of social tumult in our country, especially around issues of racism, and folks who had previously participated in electoral politics took themselves out. And that is not at all, I want to be clear, not at all the reason why the election, or the single reason why the election turned out the way that it did. But I think that in our disillusionment, we can forget the sort of totality and the scope of how politics shape our lives. And that, you know, we on a federal level, you know, I don't think that people are fully considering the Supreme Court or fully considering each and every department in the United States, or fully considering the sort of breadth and extent to which the executive branch, how far the executive branch reaches. And I think that the same goes for, as you said, Sam, on a state by state basis, right? The governor is the executive of your state. The state legislatures impact your lives oftentimes in more direct ways than the federal government. And so I just really want to push folks to, as you said, Brittany, like, hold both of those truths at once, hold both those things at once. We can move toward a different vision of what electoral politics can look like without removing ourselves completely from it, because, you know, our politicians are not going to be perfect. They have never been perfect. We should not expect them to be perfect. But what we should do is recognize the ways in which, different people have very different conceptions of what certain groups of people deserve. And we should be fully cognizant of that, and we should vote accordingly.
And, you know, I'm mindful that all the people that are the people trying to convince you that your vote doesn't matter, they're the people voting in every single election, that the right has always been really diligent about their vote while they simultaneously feed this narrative and this language about the lack of importance about a vote. The other thing is, I've heard people sort of say things like, they're not going to participate in a system that's corrupt. And it's like, well, you by virtue of being here, like, you're already a part of, you are necessarily a part of this system and structure. Like, you stopping at a stop sign is a part of a larger system and structure. And there's a way that you can participate in this through voting that, like, actually does help you exercise collective power in a different way, even if it doesn't feel like that. And that is not to take away from the real efforts at voter suppression through, like, voter ID, gerrymandering, all those things we need to deal with. But there were so many people, like you said, Brittany, who during the last election were like, you know, the president doesn't impact my life. Like, none of these people impact my life, da da da. And it's like, I think what everybody's seen so clearly is that it really does. And there's a way that you can be a part of it. And voting is one of those ways.
So if you are listening and you are wanting to make your plan to vote, write it down, because that will help make sure that you actually do it. If you have questions about your vote, you can go to rockthevote.org, look up your state and find out all the rules around voting. Just a reminder, there are 15 states and the District of Columbia that allow same day registration at your polling place. So if you are in one of those places, look it up online and find out and see if you can still show up and it's not too late to register. And at the end of the day, remember the voting booth.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Is just one place where we can seek justice and freedom. And the work will happen today and it will continue tomorrow.
Cool. Thanks, y'all.
Get out there and vote.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People is coming. And here's my conversation with Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones. Ari, thank you so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
Hey, DeRay. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
So your work right now focuses almost exclusively on the voting rights work, voter suppression, voter access. How did you get into this work?
I kind of stumbled upon this work by accident, honestly. After the 2010 election, all the way back then, I noticed all of these states had begun changing their laws to make it harder to vote. Places like Florida and Ohio and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, very important swing states. And I thought this was a very important national story that really wasn't getting covered, that this was one of the key ways that Republicans were responding to Barack Obama's election by making it harder for people to vote, primarily people of color, lower income individuals, people that were more likely to vote for Democrats than Republicans. So I started covering this first for Rolling Stone and then for The Nation magazine and then for Mother Jones. And then when the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, I became a lot more interested in the history of the Voting Rights Act and why 50 years later, we were still fighting these same kind of battles over voting rights. And that's what led me to write my book, Give Us the Ballot, and then just get a lot deeper into this whole issue of voting and really realizing that we're in a new version of a very old battle when it comes to voter suppression.
And what is that new version?
The new version, I think, is more subtle, slightly less outwardly racist, but has the same kind of effect as the laws that we saw back then. So things like requiring strict voter ID or closing polling places or cutting early voting or disenfranchising ex-offenders. People don't think of them quite the same way as poll taxes or literacy tests that just outright prevented people from voting. But if you look at the effect of the laws, they have the same kind of effect where, for example, African-American voters are less likely to possess strict forms of voter ID. They're more likely to use early voting and election day registration. They're more likely to be affected by polling place closures. They're more likely to be incarcerated because of our system of mass incarceration, meaning their voting rights are more likely to be taken away. So I think when you dig deeper, you realize that the legacy of Jim Crow is still playing out with our voting laws, but just in slightly more subtle and less obvious ways.
Now, one of the things that I appreciate about your reporting is that you cover these stories that would otherwise go unnoticed. So I'd love for you to talk about what are some stories that you think have not broken through on the national stage in the way that they should have given the impact.
Well, one of the things I was really frustrated about was the 2016 election was the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act, because when the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013 and ruled that those states with the longest histories of discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government, that ruling was really felt for the first time in the 2016 election. But there were 25 debates during the presidential election cycle, and not a single question about the attack on voting rights or the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. So I've really tried to tell that story both before the election and after the election. And I wrote a piece about the impact of Wisconsin's voter ID law, which is in the November-December issue of Mother Jones and is called Rigged. And I really looked at this one law as a microcosm of what was happening in 2016. And what I saw was that Wisconsin passed a strict voter ID law after the 2010 election. About 9% of registered voters didn't have these strict forms of ID. Black voters were 50% more likely than whites to not have these forms of ID. And I found that tens of thousands of people had been blocked from the polls during the 2016 election in Wisconsin. And I talked to voters who weren't able to cast a ballot. I talked to election officials that thought this had a key impact on the race. I cited studies like from the University of Wisconsin that found that 1 in 10 people who didn't cast a ballot in Milwaukee and Madison, the most Democratic parts of Wisconsin, were blocked or deterred from voting because of the voter ID law. That meant that 23,000 people were blocked from voting in two counties alone, and up to 45,000 statewide because of this one law, and Donald Trump only won the state by 22,700 votes. So I think that both the impact of voter suppression during the 2016 election and the fact that voter suppression is now getting worse with Republicans in control of so many states, with Jeff Sessions in charge of the Justice Department, with Chris Kobach on Donald Trump's quote-unquote Election Integrity Commission, I feel like history is going to repeat itself in the future if we don't do something about trying to protect voting rights now. What the Voting Rights Act said was that those states with the longest histories of discrimination had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. That part of the Voting Rights Act blocked 3,000 discriminatory voting changes from 1965 to 2013. So it was a huge part of the Voting Rights Act. And then the Supreme Court said that that no longer had to happen, that those states didn't need to get federal approval to implement new voting laws. What that meant is that states like Texas and North Carolina and Mississippi and Alabama rushed to pass new voter suppression measures. So it had a real tangible effect on the ground. At the same time, states that weren't covered by this provision of the Voting Rights Act, like Wisconsin and Ohio, had already put new voting restrictions in effect after the 2010 election. So we saw both that voter suppression efforts in the South were given a green light, while at the same time, the same type of voter suppression efforts were migrating to the North. And so it was sort of a two-pronged attack on voting rights. And that's why I think the Supreme Court's decision was so harmful to our democracy.
And what was the logic that they used to make that decision, that the protections were no longer needed?
The logic of Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote the opinion, was that, in his words, history had changed dramatically since 1965, but the Voting Rights Act had not. That it continued to treat the country as if it had not changed when it came to issues of voting and race, even though in Roberts' view, there had been a tremendous amount of progress. And what Ruth Bader Ginsburg said in her dissent was that that was like throwing away your umbrella because you weren't getting wet one day. It didn't mean that it wasn't going to rain the next day. And in fact, what we've seen since the Supreme Court said that history has changed was that all of these states rushed to pass new voter suppression measures that in many ways echoed Jim Crow. So history hadn't changed. In fact, what we're seeing was that the dark history of the past was resurfacing in large part because of the Supreme Court's opinion.
And what is the stuff that we can do?
Well, I think first off, as a journalist, it's really important to make people aware of what's going on. I think the fact that you guys are talking about it, I think, is really, really important because, as I mentioned, the fact that there were 25 presidential debates and not a single question about the attack on voting rights. I mean, a lot of people had no idea what was going on or why it was such a big deal. Then I think there's organizations out there that are doing really terrific work. I know you're talking to the ACLU about their work, the fact that they're doing a 50-state voting rights campaign. There's new organizations out there like Let America Vote that is trying to engage not just in the courts, but trying to sway public opinion on this issue. So I think one of the things that has always motivated me was a lot of people think, well, yeah, voting rights were a big deal in the 1960s, but we've solved that problem. People aren't being disenfranchised anymore. I hear that over and over and over. And the stories I'm trying to tell are saying, no, people are being disenfranchised. That yes, things have improved a lot since the 1960s, but we're in a new version of our very own battle here. And I think people have to understand that voting rights is not a fringe issue, but it affects every other issue. That if people care about mass incarceration or a woman's right to choose or a clean environment, if you don't have a strong right to vote, you're not going to solve any of those other problems.
Now, you talked about strict ID. What is strict ID?
Strict ID, as I define it, are limited forms of government-issued ID to cast a ballot. And I know I hear this all the time. I'm sure you hear this all the time. Well, what's a big deal? Doesn't everyone just have these kinds of ID? Well, if you look at a study from the Brennan Center for Justice, for example, 25% of African Americans do not have strict forms of government-issued ID, like a driver's license or a state photo ID, compared to a much smaller proportion of white voters. Younger voters, lower-income voters are less likely to possess these IDs. And if you look at how some of the laws are written, they're written specifically to target certain groups of people. So in Texas, under their voter ID law, you can vote with a gun permit, but not a student ID. And I think that's the kind of thing that you realize, aha, there's maybe right. a different kind of purpose to these laws beyond just trying to target voter fraud, which is a very, very small problem in American elections, and voter impersonation. The kind of fraud that a voter ID law would stop is virtually non-existent.
You also wrote this article about the North Carolina voter suppression legislation that got overturned by the courts, and that there was a particular lawyer who was defending North Carolina. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it was a guy by the name of Tom Farr. He defended North Carolina's voter suppression law in 2013 that cut early voting, required strict ID, eliminated same-day voter registration. It was called by the courts the worst voter suppression law in North Carolina since Jim Crow. He defended this law. He also defended the gerrymandering in North Carolina that federal courts said disenfranchised illegally black voters. So he has really been the go-to lawyer in North Carolina when it comes to defending voter suppression. I think even more alarming than that, he's been a longtime associate of Jesse Helms, who was really one of the most racist politicians in America for a very, very long time. So Tom Farr, who Trump has nominated as a federal judge, is one of those guys that really comes out of the Jim Crow South and has still been very, very involved with efforts to make it harder, particularly for African Americans to be able to vote. And I think the story of what Trump is doing to the judiciary has not gotten nearly enough attention, because so many people are focused on the dysfunction in Washington, but Trump is nominating judges to the federal courts every single day and getting them confirmed. And they're the people that are going to hear these cases on voting rights, on criminal justice, on so many issues. And so I think this particular story of what Trump is doing to the judiciary needs a lot more attention.
Now, what's going on in Texas? You wrote an article about the courts overturning some laws in Texas. What's going on in Texas?
So there was a remarkable string where Texas just had law after law after law overturned, both their voter ID law, where I mentioned you could vote with a gun permit but not a student ID. That law has been ruled intentionally discriminatory by the courts on three different occasions. You also had Texas redistricting plans for the state legislature and for the U.S. House ruled unconstitutional. This is all, unfortunately, working its way through the courts and taking a very long time. I think a lot of this stuff is going to end at the Supreme Court. And what makes me hopeful is that so many of these restrictions, whether it's gerrymandering or voter ID, have been overturned. What makes me nervous is they could still be reinstated by the Supreme Court. And I think when Republicans stole a Supreme Court seat from President Obama and put Neil Gorsuch on the court, they did it precisely so they would be able to put new voting restrictions and those kind of things in effect in the future. So I'm not saying this is decided at all, but I'm just saying this is another reason why the courts matter, because so much of this stuff has not only played out in the courts, but is still playing out today.
And why should we care about Kris Kobach?
That's a very good question. Well, I mean, Kris Kobach has really been the leading figure in terms of restricting voting and in terms of restricting immigration. So, I mean, I think he literally is trying to make America more white and more conservative by both reducing the non-white population and in terms of immigrants, and also reducing non-white political participation by passing voter suppression laws. And he's someone that, I mean, he's a Secretary of State of Kansas. I mean, how many other Secretaries of State can anyone name? But he has this huge national profile because Donald Trump has made him the vice chair of the quote-unquote Election Integrity Commission, which I think the worry is that they're going to spread all of these lies about voter fraud and make voter fraud seem like this massive problem in American elections, to then build support for restricting voting rights by requiring strict voter ID or purging the voting rolls or requiring a birth certificate or a passport to register to vote, which millions of Americans don't have. And so I think he's someone that Donald Trump has leaned on as a top advisor when it comes to voter fraud, when it comes to immigration. And so to me, he's really the central figure behind so many of the regressive policies that are coming out of the Trump administration. I think that's why he's someone that we should care about.
And are there any bright spots? Like, who's doing this? Is there a state leading on giving people the right to vote?
There are some bright spots. So one of the things that I'm really interested in is automatic registration. So this idea that, you know, you go to the DMV or a public agency, and if they can verify who you are and that you're eligible to vote, they'll just automatically register you to vote. Oregon did this in the last election. They were able to register 300,000 new voters through automatic registration. There was a huge jump in registration among young voters and people of color, which I thought was really significant. And Oregon, even though it wasn't a swing state, had the highest increase in voter turnout from 2012 to 2016. So this kind of policy worked really well in Oregon. 10 states have now signed on to automatic registration. The governor of Illinois just became the first Republican to sign on to an automatic registration bill, so it has bipartisan support. And I think this is the kind of future we should be in. The government has the ability to make it far easier for people to be able to vote. It's not that we don't have the ability to do this. It's that our leaders don't have the political will to get it done. So, you know, at the same time I'm looking at voter suppression in North Carolina and Wisconsin and Texas, I'm also looking at what's working in other states like Oregon and how that is also becoming a national trend now that, you know, 10 states have signed on to it. And that's one of the things that, you know, gives me hope in what is in many ways kind of dark days right now.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Ari, for joining. And we consider you a friend of the pod. Can you tell people how they can find you and access your work?
Well, thanks so much, Dere. I really enjoyed it. They can find me on Twitter at Ari Berman. They can go to my website, which is ari-berman.com, and they can read me at motherjones.com. And my book is called Give Us the Ballot.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
What?
Cool. Thanks so much, Ari.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Great to talk to you.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. And now my conversation with Faz Shakir, the National Political Director of the ACLU. Faz, thank you so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
Great to be with you, Dre. Thank you.
You're with the ACLU as the political director.
I am.
How did you get to the ACLU?
Well, so the ACLU found me to a degree. So after I worked for Harry Reid for the past 4.5 years, Anthony Romero, the executive director of the ACLU, reached out and said, hey, we've got this Trump moment and we're trying to rebuild our political muscle at the ACLU. We're looking for some top-notch people to come on board and help us flex that ACLU political muscle. Will you help us do with it? I'm like, hell yes. This is the right time, the right place, the right people. I felt really great talking with him and the senior staff, really good about the architecture of the ACLU. You got 50 state affiliates. I don't know if people know that. You got 50 state infrastructure right there. Mm-hmm. So as a political director walking in the door, you'd like, you understand you've got this incredible architecture to work with. So really it just meant kind of building in some new strength and tools and skills into this architecture.
How was it working for Reed?
Harry Reid is, man, I could spend an hour with you talking about what an amazing person that man is. He's like family to me. I mean, everything from the personal to the fact that when I had my child, he pulled my wife into the room and said, I want you to keep him home anytime you need him, and tell anyone that Harry Reid said it was okay. And that's because I don't want him here thinking about his child. When he's here, I want him thinking about work. And so if you need him home, keep him home. So things from the personal to like professional. I mean, just he would just stay by my side, helping me through all kinds of decisions that he was making and helping me think along with him. Why are we doing it this way as opposed to a different way? What's the best argument to make about this? What are the sensitivities that you have to take into consideration when building a caucus alliance on something? Just watching him work, I tell you, he's a master at it. And a lot of people say that, but there's just a style that he carried himself, which was very little ego, and a huge projection of confidence. Like, stick with me on this one. We're going to win this one. And I'm like, I'm with you.
What are the skills that you took from that experience into the ACLU?
So first of all, I mean, you look at someone who understands how to build a team. I mean, if you've talked to anyone who's ever worked with Harry Reid, the first thing they'll say is, yeah, I was part of Team Reid. I was part of a team. And that matters so much to me. When politics, and you know this better than anybody, you go into these battles with an army and you win with an army. You don't go into them alone. Is that like the strength of your personality, Dre? When you win like on the ground or even when you're getting arrested, suited up for battle, you know that you're doing it on behalf of a team that is going to back you up and it's going to fight with you on anything you're doing. And I think the manner in which he operated that kind of built a loyalty and a respect about team is the greatest asset I took away. And so like now as I work with state affiliates and other people within the organization, I'm constantly thinking about, hey, you know, we may have differences of opinion on this, but we're all working towards a team, right? We're all working towards the same goal. Just keeping that in mind.
I had David Cole on not too long ago to talk about the big pieces of, or the big cases that ACLU is focused on. What are the things that are on your plate?
So, you know, first of all, David Cole is the national legal director at the ACLU, is bringing some awesome stuff. And so it's really the kinship that we have between me and him is great. He's written a book about how much the fact that when laws change or when courts issue opinions, it's because people change the courts, that activism created the change. Everything from gun rights to LGBT rights, everything across the board, it's people who've led that movement. And so now I'm trying to build up a grassroots mobilization at the ACLU. We've done it through peoplepower.org, this building of people power through a bunch of campaigns. The latest campaign is Let People Vote campaign, which is trying to expand voting rights across the country. And you look at what we're trying to do, it's in tandem with the law. The problem with the law, let me talk to you about the problem with the law.
But teach us.
When you're fighting litigation and using litigation as a tactic, you're always fighting on defense, right? Because something had to have happened.
For there to be a lawsuit.
Right. And then you bring a lawsuit, you find a client who can have standing in fighting that case, and you're trying to stop that bad thing from happening. And hopefully in stopping that bad thing from happening, you're saving a lot of other people from that bad thing. But now, you know, what we're trying to do is change law to allow positive things to happen. We're going to play on offense here, not just defense. Play on offense and take these opportunities. So litigation would approach voting rights by saying, where's voter suppression being felt? Let's find a client. Let's fight against that voter suppression ID bill. And I'm saying, okay, we could keep doing that for literally the next 20, 30 years and just get nowhere. Like, we got to do that. It's like kind of like mandatory. But if we're going to really change the ball game, you got to go out and advocate for changes in laws that expand access to the ballot, that make our democracy more representative. And that's, you can only, I think, do that right now by advocating at the state level for state changes, state by state by state by state by state, because there's nothing passing out of Congress right now.
So people have heard about voter suppression, like in the news generally, and about the importance of these laws. But how would you pitch this issue to people for whom it's new to them?
So if I was talking to somebody who doesn't understand anything about voting in America. First of all, we got a broken system. Let's just be honest about it. We got a patchwork system. Different states have different laws. And there are so many different rules that govern it, from how early can I vote? Like, some states you can vote like many weeks before the election. In other states, you can only vote on the day of the election. How can I get registered? Different states, you can vote by mail. Some states you have to like literally show up with like reams and reams of documents and papers, and maybe you'll get registered. So I think that first thing you need to understand is we're talking about a system that's broken. It's got a lot of different laws in place. And so when you, as advocates who are trying to make the system better, you have to appreciate that each state has its own remedy. You're not probably going to have a nationwide easy answer to this problem. There's certain national responses that would be wonderful, like we should reenfranchise all ex-felons and give them the right to vote back on a national scale. That would be great to do. But our dysfunctional Congress as it is, it's not going to happen anytime soon. So I would say to that layperson, hey, if you want to fix the system, you got to understand the laws and the policies in your state. You're in Maryland, you're in Florida, you're in Nebraska, understand the laws, and then let's work together to identify what are those incremental changes that we can do that will expand the right of people to vote. And for each state, that answer is different. We're engaged in this effort. We've worked with all of our 50 state affiliates to come up with what is that incremental, or in some cases, not even incremental, but a substantial change to empower more people to get access to the ballot.
So I don't want to put you on the spot, but can you, this isn't a quiz, I'm trying to understand, can you pick like three states and help us think through like what they'd be?
So here we go. Well, let's start with Florida, because I know you and I care a lot about what's going on in Florida right now. So we'll start with Florida. And that is that 1.5 million people there who are ex-felons do not have the right to vote. Why is that? Because in 1868, think about when that was. We had the Black Codes in Florida. After the passage of 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that granted the power and the right and the equality of African Americans to vote, a number of states say, hey, I'm going to find a way for you not to vote. And they say, well, we're going to create a whole bunch of new felonies, and then we're going to stop felons from voting, and then we're going to trap you in the system. It's existed since 1868, right? It's crazy. So here we are in 2017, and the way we're going to change this is change this Florida state constitution, because it's in the state constitution. The only way you can do that is through a ballot initiative. And we are collecting signatures. We're going to, knock on wood here, we're going to get to our requisite number by the end of this year, which is about 800,000, let's say, by 800,000 signatures verified by the end of this year. And then we're going to be on the ballot. And so in November of 2018, we got to get 60% plus and end this radical injustice that exists in Florida and re-enfranchise 1.5 million plus people. So that's Florida, right? And that means just signature gathering. Hey, everybody, bust your ass, get out there, let's get some signatures. There's going to be a lot of things that just happen through the state legislature. So like, let's stick with felon re-enfranchisement for a moment. So in Nebraska, they have actually passed a bill where they ban people, for ex-felons, from voting for 2 years. They have a 2-year wait period. Why? Who the hell knows? It doesn't make any sense, but you have to sit for 2 years and wait for your right to get restored. So they've passed a bill through there that would waive that 2-year waiting period. And the governor vetoed it last session.
Now, why should felons have the right to vote?
So here's the way I would say that. This is the way I would answer that. Everyone should have the right to vote. I don't care if you're talking about a felon or not, honestly. Everyone should have the right to vote. Now, felons, it has become a backward system in America in which we believe that if you committed a crime, you lose the privilege of voting. So it's not thought of as a right. It's thought of as a privilege, and we can take it away from you. And there are a lot of politicians eager to take that away from you because they're worried about felons voting for the other person, right? So that's fundamentally what's behind the case. So like, okay, fine. We have this stupid system that takes away people's right to vote if they're a felon and in jail. So what we should at least agree to is that if you've paid your debt to society and you've come out and you're working to rehabilitate your life, and we as a society are working to rehabilitate you in many different ways, why can't we give you the damn right to vote? And so I think at the very least, people who've paid their debt to society should get their right to vote back. That's something that should be core and basic and yet doesn't exist. So should we, another state? I'm just going to
pick a three. I didn't forget.
Okay. Do you want to pick one? I'm just going to.
No. This is, you tell, you're the expert. I'm just asking the questions, trying to understand. Florida, I knew about. So,
okay. So it's helpful. We'll just go to
Nebraska. I didn't know about.
Yeah. So, I mean, we had a couple big buckets and you and I have talked about, re-enfranchisement of felons. Can I give you two more states? Because I want to exemplify the two different things. So the other major problem we face in America is our partisan gerrymander.
Mm-hmm.
And Georgia is working on a plan to essentially empower an independent, nonpartisan commission to redraw the lines.
Okay.
And
that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's absolutely a great thing. Our system is are disenfranchising so many people from their vote being counted because of gerrymanders.
Now, explain gerrymandering quickly. Gerrymandering 101 is what?
So, gerrymandering is essentially the drawing of the lines in a state about where your vote is cast and counted when it comes to voting for anything from state legislator to your national congressman, right? And so you vote based on your geography, and the people arbitrarily draw lines. It would surprise no one to know that the reason that lines are drawn the way they are is for incumbency protection. People who've been in office want to continue to remain in office, so they draw the lines that benefit them the most, whether you're Democrat or Republican. So one of the best examples of this is in Wisconsin, which is broken in many ways on voting. In Wisconsin, they had a Republican state house who won by a slim margin. Right, a slim margin of the vote statewide, and got 60% of the state house seats. Then the next cycle, they win by a much larger margin. Republicans in the state house is 60%. That tells you that the fact that people are voting in droves and turning out in different ways is not being reflected whatsoever in the composition of their state electorate body.
Hmm.
It's what we want is your vote to count. We want it to matter. And so having independent redistricting is critical because you got to have, I think that there's multi-layers to this. One is you got to have people who aren't invested in the outcome of where those lines are drawn, experts. But you also want probably a system with nowadays we have so much data. We should be able to do this with computers,
right,
who account for here's people of color, here's representational issues that we've got to have, and we'll factor this all in a fair way. There shouldn't be people drawing lines arbitrarily. So there's much better ways to do this, and it starts with an independent redistricting commission. So in Georgia, we're advocating for this issue, and then a number of states, but Georgia is one of them. And so last, kind of go to my last bucket. So last is election reforms. And one of the most powerful reforms that you can do on election reform. So things expand the early vote, no excuse absentee voting. But the one that I'm going to talk about that we love the most is called—
What is excuse absentee voting?
No excuse absentee voting.
But what's the opposite?
Vote.
What's excuse absentee
voting? So some states will stop you from being able to vote early absentee because you aren't in the list of the things that are deemed to be an excuse. So I'm traveling overseas or I'm stationed overseas, right, for the military. Or
those are normally okay.
Yeah, those would be reasons why, yes, you can vote absentee early.
But if I just wanted to stay at home.
Right.
Got it.
They're like, nope, you can't do it.
And no excuse absentee is I should, no matter what the reason is, I should be able to mail my ballot in.
That's right.
Got it. Okay.
That's right. And we want that, right? We want that. We want to make it easier for people to say, hey, I'm traveling, or hey, I'm having a child in a month, so can I vote now? In Virginia, we're doing that, no excuse absentee. But the one that we really care about the most, that we're fired up about, and that Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, hates the most, the Trump guy who's leading this voter fraud commission, is the issue of election day registration. It's huge. If you can register and vote on election day, it's a game changer.
Why?
Because you think about, first, get out the vote operations. Everyone's hustling on day of to get out the vote. And on that day, you learn from so many people, oh, shoot, I didn't register. And it's like, well, there's nothing we can do for you now. You know, right. We wish you had registered. So really, the ability to just knock down walls and say, hey, today is your day. Even if you had done nothing up to now, I can drive you to the polls and your vote can be counted. I can help you get your voice counted. Much easier burden to overcome, right? For the 40% of the American public who has checked out of our politics, right? Remember, yeah. We're being represented by essentially 60% of the voting public. 40% still out there. How do we get them engaged? Knock down these walls. Election day registration. Just show up, register, vote. You'll be counted. And so we're doing that in a number of places. This is the one that we care most about. And if states wanted to work with us on, we're like, hey, you want to do something? Do this one, election day registration. So Kansas is our big one. And I say Kansas because we're working with a big coalition there, but it happens to be the home state of Kris Kobach. And he hates it. I mean, he's openly talked about how, oh, you know, that means that you can drive in from out of state and just cast your vote. And so he argued this in North New Hampshire recently. He's like, well, you know, New Hampshire, all these college kids drove in from out of state and changed the vote. And the Secretary of State of New Hampshire, who's on the Trump commission with Kris Kobach, it's like, you don't know what the hell you're talking about, dude. He tells him, like, guy, you know, like the reason that people came in and voted was that they were students who were in freaking New Hampshire. They were right. Dartmouth students. They were College of New Hampshire or whatever, University of New Hampshire. They were in state and they had out of state driver's licenses because maybe they lived somewhere else, but then they voted in state. So what they did in New Hampshire is crazy, but they tried to pass a law, or they have passed a law to actually fine you. If you don't take a second affirmative step as a student after the vote has occurred, so like I go in and vote on Tuesday, let's say, I'm supposed to now by state law come in 3 days later, within 3 days, and show you that I live in dorm room X at the university.
That passed?
Or I will get fined thousands of dollars.
Wow.
$5,000. Crazy, right? They're just literally
trying
to
fine. How did that pass? Like, did we just not know enough? Did it like slide under the radar?
They mobilized quickly. Yeah, they mobilized very quickly and passed it. Yeah, in the state of New Hampshire. You know, it's unfortunate. I was like, these are the kinds of laws that people are probably not really focused on that have really detrimental effect on participation rates across the country. I mean, you wonder like, hey, why didn't more people vote and why is the margin so thin? It's because they're trying to stop you from voting. That is what is going on. And we have to obviously work our asses off to overcome that. We shouldn't just take it and be like, well, you know, they put up all these barriers. No, like, you know, why even bother? I mean, you still got to like work our tails off and overcome those barriers. But in the meantime, let's work to change these laws.
Now, can you talk to me a little bit about the purging?
Yeah.
What's happening with the purge?
So in Ohio, so you're referring to, I mean, it's obviously happened in a lot of places. It's happened in Georgia. It's happened in Ohio. And this
for people who know nothing about vote purging, what's happening?
Yeah, I'm going to define it for you. So vote purging is occurring in many Republican-led states, honestly, where they are going through the voting rolls and they're saying, hey, did you vote in the last cycle? Did you vote in the last two cycles? If you didn't vote in the last two cycles, you're off the rolls. We're just going to send you a notice. You're kicked off. And obviously, like, why would somebody want to do that? Well, going to the issue we were talking about before, incumbency factor. So if you're winning office with your people, your small group of people come out and voting for you, then yeah, you want to kick other people out. And you want to make an easy system to kick people out. So in Ohio, we have a case that's going up before the Supreme Court. And our friends at Demos and us, we're working together on that case. And we're arguing that the thousands of voters who've been hundreds of thousands have been kicked off of the voting rolls is unconstitutional and it's a violation of their state law. And so we are, I mean, it's just, it doesn't make any sense, Dre. Like, why would you take every, I mean, in Ohio, it was just like you miss one election cycle and you're off the rolls. One election cycle. What the hell?
Aren't voters upset about that though?
I hope so. We don't know yet. I hope so. I mean, like the fact is in places like Georgia and places like Ohio, this is occurring. Like they're doing it to you. And we're trying to work with our coalition partners to get people out in the streets and say, like, we're pissed off about this and make sure you register your vote on election day and change this nonsense. But But I don't know. I mean, you listen to the other side and they say, well, you know, it's just voter maintenance and we just want to make sure we're not wasting money on keeping people on the rolls. Well, there's easier ways to do this. If that's your serious concern, then we can work on a system that doesn't just take people automatically off the rolls. You go through a verification process of the people on the rolls, make sure that they either are dead or have moved out of state. There's a way to verify that. And then you carefully take people off the rolls. But what they're doing is just like, hey, first gut instinct, you're off the rolls. You know, let me just...
What do you say? You know, one of the other things that they say, though, is that there's all this voter fraud happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that is the big myth in this country, is that there's major voter frauds. And like, literally, what you find when you dig into the data in this is that in those small number of instances, tiny, I'm talking about a handful of instances where somebody voted in a state and should not have. I'm talking about like count on one hand or two hands, the number of instances. Almost every single one of those, because the person didn't know they were doing it illegally. They were like, you know, I had just moved to a different state. I thought I was registered here. I guess I did. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that. Or I'm an ex-felon. I didn't realize ex-felons are barred from voting here. I was just trying to vote. You know, I'm going through the immigration process. I thought I had gotten my, you know, the green card status. I was fine to vote. Didn't realize it. Just like tiny numbers, right. All done.
It's not people being like, I'm trying to subvert democracy.
Exactly. Like, okay. No intentionality here. So like, but let's think about like, why do they propound the voter fraud myth? Why do they keep saying that there's millions upon millions of people who are voting illegally? Because it is the path to disenfranchising a lot of people. Yeah. If you can convince people, then you can put in place all kinds of voter ID restrictions and make it much more difficult for people to vote, particularly people of color. And obviously, Republicans look at people of color as the enemy and see them as the reason see them as the people who are voting for their opponents. And so we just got to stop that from happening.
Now, where can people go to either find out what they need to do in their state, join a group of people that are working on these issues? What can people do?
So, you know, what I would suggest is a first-stop shopping. You know, I'm from the ACLU. We've got a 50-state campaign that we're very proud of. Vote.peoplepower.org. Vote.peoplepower.org will get you involved in selecting your state. So identify where your state is, and then you see what your plan is for that particular state. Whether you're from Florida, you talked about Florida, how to get involved in Florida ballot petition gathering, or, you know, Nebraska, and start working the state legislator, overturn this two-year waiting period. Georgia, you know, let's do the redistricting thing. So it depends on where you live, and I hope you go to vote.peoplepower.org. We're working with a bunch of coalition partners, so if you happen to be a coalition who is in one of these states and wants to work with us to get this done, please reach out to me directly. I'm fshakir@aclu.org. I love receiving email. Fshakir, fshakir@aclu.org.
And, you know, in moments like this, people are losing hope. They feel like the world's like falling apart. What do you say to those people?
It's hard right now. It's difficult. You look at like vulnerable people across the community, across the country, and look at like what Trump's been saying to them. We want to wall you out. We want to ban you. We want to detain you, deport you, surveil you, call you guilty without due process, stop and frisk you, take your land and water, build an oil pipeline through it, take away your health care. If you're a woman, make your health care decisions for you, stop you from voting. You know, all that crap. It is demoralizing. It is tough. It is hard to suffer through. Got to persist, first of all. Got to persist. It doesn't get better until we make it better. But I also think, you know, and this is for me personally, everyone comes to the politics for a different reason. And I swear to you, DeRay, like if politics was awesome, it was a utopia, I would be coaching high school baseball right now. That is what I would be much more excited to do with
my
life.
Did you play baseball as a kid?
Yeah, I played baseball and played in college and high school and got recruited. It was something that I love. I would be on the ball field, and I love teaching. I love coaching. That'd be what I'd be doing now. But it's because politics is unjust that I stay engaged in this. It's the injustices every day that drive me. And I've taken an attitude, and I hope more people share it, that if not me, then who? You know, like to see Trump become the president of the United States, what a full frontal assault and slap in the face it is to so many of us. Like, it really, in many days, as someone who's raised Muslim, brown skin, weird name, you know, there are days I wake up and feel like, man, I'm like his enemy. I mean, he hates me. He's like really engaged in trying to like put together policies that demean me and demoralize me
every day.
Every day.
Yeah.
And not just me, right? Like trans, if you're Latino, if you're African American, you're feeling the same thing I'm feeling. So I understand that, but like it is those injustices that drive me. That's not for everybody, but I hope that you feel a little bit about that. That like you see, you looked into the face of evil policies and you said, "Damn, all right, got work to do."
And repeat one more time where people can find you and where people can find the next steps.
Sure. So first of all, you can find me, Faz Shakir, National Political Director, fshakir@aclu.org. Like I said, I love email, love hearing from people. So you can always contact me. Peoplepower.org is our grassroots hub, our mobilization arm for the ACLU. Obviously, if you want to know anything and everything about ACLU, it's aclu.org and on Twitter at ACLU.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Posse of the People. We consider you a friend of the pod, and we'll see you back soon.
Hey, I got to give you a quick plug because I really care about this, which is that, you know, you Duray, I've seen and watched you in many ways. And I just love people who live their values, you know, and I see you.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Kind of suit up to get arrested. You get suit up to mobilize people. You suit up to run for office. You suit up to fight the fight. And I just wanted to take a moment to just say, like, I appreciate that. I appreciate that a lot.
I appreciate it. Thank you. You know, I'm one of many people who wants to figure out how to change the world. So we can do it.
Thank you for being here.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. And here's my conversation with Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League. You know that in the Anti-Defamation League's latest audit of anti-Semitic incidents, it reports that from January 1st to September 30th, there were 1,299 anti-Semitic incidents across the United States, including physical assaults, vandalism, and attacks on Jewish institutions. I'm looking forward to this conversation with Jonathan. Jonathan Greenblatt, thank you for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
I'm glad to be here.
How'd you end up at the ADL? That's not where you started.
It's definitely not where I started. So most previously to this, I worked for President Obama in the White House. I was his special assistant, and I ran the Office of Social Innovation. So I was focused on how do we use innovation to accelerate economic recovery, boost job creation. I did that for 3.5 years. Before that, I was out in California building businesses. I worked in technology and software. I co-founded Ethos Water, a business, a bottled water business that uses its profits to help children get clean water. And we sold it to Starbucks in 2005, and I worked there for some time as a senior executive. I also started a venture called All for Good that was incubated at Google and built with Google engineers. And then that was acquired in 2011. So I'm kind of a startup guy. I'm a social entrepreneur, and I'm a rehabilitated public servant.
Now, when a lot of people think about the Anti-Defamation League, they think about sort of primarily Jewish issues. What do you say to people who say to you all that you should just stay in that lane, that you should just fight anti-Semitism, that's what you should do? Why is your mission broader than that in some ways? And what do you say to critics?
Yeah, I mean, when we were founded in 1913, it was an amazing thing because the Jewish community was weak and vulnerable in this country. We didn't have any of the economic power or kind of, you know, social capital we have today. And yet the founders who created ADL to fight for the Jewish community also wrote in its mission, it would fight for all people. When America is good for all its minorities, it's also good for its Jewish people. And so our founders realized that, and that's the reason why in 1952 we filed an amicus brief in Brown v. Board of Education. That's the reason why we participated in the among the Freedom Riders. That's the reason why my predecessor in the summer, in February of 1965, marched with Dr. King in Selma and many, many other people. And look today in Charlottesville, when those neo-Nazis and white supremacists marched, they were saying horribly racist things and anti-Semitic things. They were talking about preserving the Confederacy, and then they were saying Jews will not replace us. The fight against racism is interlinked with the fight against anti-Semitism, and the fight against anti-Semitism is interwoven with the fight against racism. We have a shared struggle and a common purpose to ensure that America lives up to the ideals of its founders. That's why we're focused on fighting intolerance, all forms.
So in the public, we've seen anti-blackness show up very overtly. And I think that for so many people, Charlottesville was the first time they saw like white supremacists literally say Jews will not replace us. Like it was so overt for the first time for some people.
Yeah.
How would you explain sort of the way that anti-Semitism shows up in America and in ways that we can fight it?
Well, I think, you know, again, I think anti-Semitism is one of the, you know, it's often described as the oldest hatred. For 2,000 years since, you know, Jews were expelled from, you know, ancient Jerusalem by the Romans, they've lived in exile in countries around the world. And very often, unfortunately, more often than not, that those exiles, if you will, that has ended with either forced conversion, repeated exile, or persecution and death. And we've seen this again and again in the Middle East, and we've seen this again and again in Europe. It's a pretty ugly history. Here in the United States, we've lived with tremendous privilege, you know, since the country was founded hundreds of years ago. And there's certainly been incidences of prejudice. Sometimes this shows up when people, let's say they decry, like Steve Bannon, they say, you know, I don't have a problem with the Jewish state. It's just globalists that I have a problem with. And we saw this during the Trump campaign, like that last ad where he showed a series of faces that he talked about pushing an international banking conspiracy to destroy U.S. sovereignty. And funny enough, they were all Jews, individuals who had nothing to do with one another. And then sometimes we see this coming from the left as well, where they, you know, they blame the quote unquote neocons for pushing the country to war. And they don't mention Donald Rumsfeld. They don't mention Dick Cheney or Condi Rice. They only mention the Jews, like this newspaper columnist or this person at a think tank or this, you know, junior person at the Defense Department, as if somehow there was a conspiracy of Jews pushing the country to war. So anti-Semitism can be subtle, but it often is rooted in a conspiratorial belief that there are Jews somehow plotting to take over the world or to sow unrest or to seek special status for themselves. I think it's incumbent upon us to realize that racism isn't just your problem, DeRay, as a black man. It's my problem as an American Jew. And anti-Semitism isn't just my problem as an American Jew. It's your problem as well as a black man. We can't have justice in this country unless there's justice for everyone. And intolerance is our shared enemy. We've got to do everything we can to fight it.
Now, what can we do about it? What can the Anti-Defamation League do about it? What can regular people, or sort of people not in organizations, everyday citizens, what can they do about it?
I think there's, it's a good question. What can we do about it? So let me first break that down, what the ADL is doing about it, and then what individuals can do about it. What the ADL can do about it? Well, we have this network of 26 offices, like I said. We have educational programming. We have law enforcement training. We have free speech experts. So one of the things that we did immediately after Charlottesville is we partnered with the U.S. Conference of Mayors, because we know there are more rallies being planned. We know that white supremacists are recruiting on college campuses. We know that they are increasing, expanding their efforts on social media. So we reached out to the U.S. Conference of Mayors and said, let us help your other mayors get ready and prepare themselves proactively so we don't have another repeat of the debacle that we saw in Charlottesville. Together with the U.S. Conference of Mayors, we launched the Mayor's Compact. You can see it at mayorscompact.org, a 10-point plan that mayors can adopt to inoculate their communities from intolerance. It's a series of concrete steps they can take in advance in order to reduce the risk of, again, the kind of racism that was on full display in Charlottesville. It includes things like making sure your law enforcement is ready, that your schools are ready, that you're ready to step up. DeRay, literally, we pulled this together in the aftermath of Charlottesville. Today, we have over 350 mayors who've signed up. These are all the big city mayors. These are small town mayors. These are Republicans. These are Democrats. These are blue states. These are red states. All over the country, mayors are saying enough. So I'm pleased about that. And now we're following up to make sure that every community in this country is immunized against intolerance. Now, I think other things people can do is you can volunteer. You can get involved. Organizations, not just like ADL, NAACP, Unidos, HRC, SPLC, ACLU. There are a number of great organizations working to make an impact on these issues. So people can get involved, whether that means signing an online petition or showing up to lick envelopes.
And what about cyber hate? You know, the internet has become a place that is beautiful for letting people express their views in ways that they've not been able to do before, but it also has become a place for people are being hateful in ways that we've not seen happen before. Like the mechanism just didn't exist. What can we do about that? What can the ADL do about that or is doing about
that? I'm really glad you asked about that because this is a big, I mean, the front line in the fight against hate is on Facebook. And we have certainly seen extremists exploit these platforms. They've innovated their approach to spread their message and again, to target and terrorize minorities. And frankly, the technology is developing so quickly. Washington hasn't caught up. I think even the companies themselves have failed to grasp the extent of the problem. But that's changed in the last year. You know, we at the ADL, I announced at South by Southwest earlier this year, we're launching a center for technology and society in Silicon Valley. We're going to have a dedicated physical presence in the epicenter of innovation that's focused specifically on creating partnerships with the companies, not just to push back in terms of policy and making sure, for example, you know, their terms of use forbid the kind of, again, slander and abuse that we're talking about. But also, we just launched a problem-solving lab. Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Twitter joined forces with the ADL to create the lab, which is developing product-based and engineering approaches to address online abuse and to reduce cyber hate.
Now, the ADL is also doing work around sports. What is that work?
I'm really proud of that. So, you know, we were, I was reached out to by folks from the NBA and the NFL after the president's, you know, ridiculousness. I mean, we're really in a moment when the president equivocates on neo-Nazis and prefers to tweet at NFL players who are exercising their First Amendment rights. It's really quite a moment in time. So they reached out to us and we had been planning on doing something. And then we announced the creation of a sports leadership council because we think that sports should be a way to unite the country, not to divide us. And we think that sports offers opportunities, whether it's on the court, you know, or in the locker room where athletes, you know, men and women, boys and girls come together as equals, not as, you know, people of difference. And so we launched the Sports Leadership Council to use sports as a strategy, again, to convene communities and to push back on prejudice. We announced this with us. Our initial members include Billie Jean King, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Ronnie Lott, the Hall of Famer with the 49ers, as well as owners from the NFL, the NBA, and Major League Baseball. And the plan is, much as we're working now through city halls around the country, to work through amateur and professional sports teams and organizations to use them as platforms to address issues of diversity and to use them proactively, again, to push back on prejudice. So we'll be rolling out a range of different programs across the country at the high school, college, and professional level in all sports to engage in the kind of conversations that I think the country is ready to have. So more to come on that in the next couple months.
And what's the work that you do in schools? I know that you talked about training teachers. But what does that look like? What's the scope? I think that is, when I learned about it, I was surprised. I didn't know that was work the ADL did, but I'd love to know more about that.
Sure. So again, as I mentioned earlier, decades ago, the ADL realized you can't like litigate or arrest your way out of intolerance. You got to change hearts and minds. So we've developed a series of two main product lines, if you will, a program called No Place for Hate and another called A World of Difference. And these educational programs are distributed at the local level to elementary, middle, and high schools. And it's based on a model where kids train other kids and kids take leadership roles. So it's about leadership development of students where they tackle issues of difference. So these are universal values, and they tackle issues like homophobia, racism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, you know, anti-immigration sentiment. I think the misogyny, and these can be, some of the programs happen at the classroom level, some happen at the school-wide level through assemblies and whatnot, but it's all about engaging kids to take a leadership role and train other kids on why tolerance is important. I'm expanding that work now. And programs like the Sports Leadership Council and the Mayor's Compact will help to get our content in front of more kids, because that's where we think change really happens.
Got it. Well, thanks for coming on Pod Save the People today. We consider you a friend of the pod, and we hope to have you back soon.
I'm grateful for that. Keep up the good work.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People. Make sure that you share it. Make sure that you rate it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I will see you back next week. Wow.